This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Yesterday at Portsmouth High School in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Bernie Sanders stepped to the microphone behind a sign reading Stronger Together to make an announcement.
I have come here today not to talk about the past, but to focus on the future. That future will be shaped more by what happens on November 8th in voting booths across our nation than by any other event in the world. I have come here to make it as clear as possible as to why I am endorsing Hillary Clinton. And why she must become our next president.
Many in the Democratic Party were waiting for 5 weeks since the California primary for Sanders to utter those words. Today, we will discuss what concessions Sanders received and what role he might play in the general election. We're joined today by Bert Johnson, who chairs the Political Science Department at Middlebury College. Hello again, Professor Johnson. Nice to talk with you.
Hi, Jane. Happy to be here.
And by VPR's own Bob Kinzel. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Jane.
So, Bob, what took him so long to make the announcement?
Well, I think he really had some leverage in terms of the issues that would be included in the Democratic platform. And a lot of people, as you mentioned, wanted him to endorse Hillary Clinton after the California primary at the beginning of June. But he felt very strongly there were a number of issues he wanted in that platform, something he referred to yesterday as the most progressive platform in the history of the Democratic Party. So he had to use that leverage of withholding the endorsement until he got those issues in there. You know, things like working towards a $15 an hour minimum wage, a big expansion of the federal community health centers, free tuition at public colleges for low and middle income students, working towards a ban on fracking. So I think he needed that leverage in order to get what he wanted in the Democratic platform.
Do you agree, Professor Johnson?
I absolutely agree with Bob and with my colleague Matt Dickinson, quoted in the news segment there, that he used as much leverage as he possibly could. And this is why you see him waiting until almost the very last moment to make this endorsement. I thought it was a solid endorsement, although it got more full-throated as he went along.
But didn't Hillary Clinton have things she wanted to get out of the Democrats as well in 2008? And yet she endorsed Barack Obama just, I think it was, what, 4 days after the end of the primary season?
That's true, although her aims might have been a little bit different from Bernie Sanders' aims. Bernie Sanders is leading a very progressive faction of the Democratic Party, and she was not at that time. That faction was being led by Barack Obama. So she had more of her personal interests perhaps at stake than Bernie Sanders does right now.
Bob, you've covered Bernie Sanders for many, many years now. Do you think from watching his body language, from listening to his voice, from hearing the words that he said, that it was a full-throated endorsement of Hillary Clinton yesterday?
Jane, I thought it was. I thought it was very convincing. I mean, the Clinton campaign got the photo they really wanted. That was the two candidates standing side by side, waving to folks. And I think a lot of people were waiting to see, would Sanders say, I strongly endorse Hillary Clinton, or would his message be more of, we have to defeat Donald Trump? And it was really both. I mean, he had some very kind things to say about Hillary Clinton, that she's a very strong candidate. She's a very intelligent person. She's the person that he think should lead this country for the next 4 to 8 years. So I thought it was a pretty strong endorsement.
Yeah, people were waiting on bated breath for that word endorse, which took him a little while to say. But as we played in that clip earlier, he did say, make it very clear, I am endorsing Hillary Clinton, because those were the words that people were kind of waiting for, Bob.
Exactly. I mean, he had to say that as far as the Clinton campaign was concerned, and he said it several times, and I thought he was very sincere. I mean, it could not have been an easy event for Bernie Sanders, because he was really ending his presidential campaign. He got many of the goals that he wanted in the Democratic platform, but this was an acknowledgement that he's not going to be the candidate and that Hillary Clinton is.
We are talking about this long-awaited endorsement of Hillary Clinton by Bernie Sanders yesterday, and looking at how people feel about it. Was it inevitable? Was it something that disappointed you if you are a Bernie Sanders supporter? Does that endorsement actually sway your vote, even if you anticipated it? What are you thinking now, and what do you think he will do now that he's endorsed somebody else for president? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a comment on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We've been getting some comments from disappointed Bernie Sanders supporters. June in Jericho says, I think Bernie supporters are being asked to make a leap overnight that Bernie and his staffers had a month or two to perform. I feel like I'm being asked to leap over common sense and years of reasonable distrust. I do not want Hillary Clinton as my president, and I do not relish the thought of Bill Clinton back at the White House after his thoughtless actions paved the way for Al Gore to lose to George W. Bush. So I need to know what makes Bernie believe that Hillary will follow through on the platform. Catherine in Troy, New York says, I've been gagging for 24 hours. And she follows up her comment with the hashtag Jill Stein for president. Jill Stein, of course, the Green Party candidate. Garen says, as a formally donating Sanders supporter, I'm disappointed in his decision to endorse Clinton. I hope the political movement that built up around him will continue on and help bring an end to the two-party system we have today. Seems Americans demand choice. Just look at the toothpaste aisle in everything but our politics. And then we got a note from Jane, who strikes a different tone, and she says, what did you honestly think would happen? That he'd keep going right through Election Day? That he'd drop out and not endorse? I don't understand what exactly people thought was going to happen. At the end of the day, Sanders is a politician. He's been in the game long enough to know that if he did not endorse, the Dems would make the rest of his time in the Senate miserable and would be looking to actively contest his seat in Vermont. That's just how it is. Sanders spending 30-plus days to finally get to this point caused a division of resources, time, media attention, etc. That is not what the Democrats want. Bert Johnson, what do you think? I mean, some people there are really frustrated, and Jane saying, this is just common sense. Of course it was going to happen.
Well, I think what you're seeing in some of the frustration that's coming out in those emails is it illuminates something else that Bernie Sanders is trying to do in that speech yesterday. Part of the reason, as Bob was saying, that the speech was a little bit tentative to start with is perhaps because of personal disappointment on his part. But there's also the job that he has to do of managing all those supporters, many of whom are disappointed, and particularly disappointed are those that are most committed to his cause. So what he's got to do is to make this move in a way that won't alienate them and will preserve their effort for what he wants to do next. And he sent an email to his supporters yesterday saying that he aims to found successor organizations, as he called them. And so he's going to need that support going forward.
When it comes, though, to this endorsement, Bert, I mean, there were Bernie supporters who walked out of the room when he officially endorsed Clinton yesterday. But for whatever they're worth, polls are showing that most Bernie supporters had already said they'd vote for Hillary even before the endorsement came down. So does it really matter? I mean, he may sway some people with this endorsement, but it sounds like most of his supporters were going to go in her direction anyhow.
That's right. Most of them are. And most of them are actually going in her direction more quickly than they were going in Barack Obama's direction had they supported her in 2008. So we can see that in the polls. So in terms of the election outcome, does this matter? Probably not. But again, I think if Bernie Sanders wants to carry this movement, as he calls it, forward, he's going to need those supporters with him and not disillusioned.
And you think he got them by giving that speech?
I mean, I think most of them, yes. I think that they'll mostly come around, especially once he lays out his plans for the future.
Bob, do you think the endorsement matters really in campaign politics, or at least in who's going to vote for whom?
Oh, I think it does. And I think that the email that you had about the person who said Bernie Sanders has had some weeks to think about this, I'm trying to deal with it within 24 or 48 hours, really hits the mark. I think that, you know, there are 80% of Sanders supporters right now will probably vote for Hillary Clinton. Even though they see some differences between Sanders and Clinton, they also see there's a huge contrast with Donald Trump. And then they're the ones who are going to need some time. They need to really focus on this and think about this. But they've got 4 months to do that. And I think national polling shows that in the summertime of a presidential election, there are a fair number of people who are considering voting for independent candidates, be that the Green Party candidate, Jill Stein, or the Libertarian candidate, Gary Johnson. But then as you get closer and closer to the election, those folks say, well, let's think about this a little bit. And those folks are going to have to decide in late October, is there really a difference between Hillary Clinton and Donald Donald Trump? And if they come to the answer no, then I think they support one of the third party candidates. But if they say, you know, on balance, there really is, that's going to be enough to sway them to vote for Hillary Clinton.
But really, I mean, to Jane's comment, no relation to me, Jane, that idea that really you only had 24 hours. We've known this is coming since California, if not sooner. Are people really feeling bruised by this endorsement, you think, Bob?
Well, I think they were holding out hope in the last couple of weeks that something might happen to change the dynamics of this race. Who knows how the whole Hillary Clinton email situation was going to affect the race. So I think they were holding out, hoping there might be some way for Bernie Sanders to be the Democratic presidential nominee. And now they're just coming to grips with the fact that he's not going to be.
Jill Stein did send out a press release after the Bernie Sanders endorsement of Hillary Clinton. And she wrote, "What is most disappointing is that Sanders has refused invitations to speak to the Green Party, a truly Democratic national party that has long championed the progressive stance that lifted the Sanders campaign to the top of national polls." So disappointment there from the Green Party and disappointment that they can't get him to speak to them. Let's go to Matt, who's calling in from Corinth. Hi, Matt. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
To be blunt, I think Bernie is a sellout. Ever since he announced the start of his campaign in Burlington, I was the most excited in a presidential candidate that I had ever been. In fact, I even volunteered for his campaign during the New Hampshire primary, and I had never done that before. From the start, Bernie had always said that he was an anti-establishment candidate, and Hillary is for the establishment. So I don't understand why he now suddenly has thrown his support behind her.
Well, he has really said, Matt, that he would do anything to prevent Donald Trump from becoming the president.
Well, yeah, which actually brings me to my next comment is I actually will be voting for Donald Trump now because I cannot vote for Hillary Clinton. Although she has agreed to take on some of Bernie's points that he has campaigned for, in all honesty, I don't believe that she will carry them out.
So will you be happy with a Trump presidency?
Yeah, at this point I would. I think I'll be much happier with a Trump presidency than a Clinton presidency.
Matt, thanks for your comments. I appreciate that. Nice to hear from you. Let's go to Richard in Haverhill, Massachusetts. Hi, Richard. Your thoughts?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, thanks, Jane. I don't know if that was a millennial, but I have a feeling a lot of millennials will not vote for Hillary. You know, the latest poll, Quinnipiac poll, Jane, Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio, he's either tied with her or a little ahead. I mean, that's pretty frightening. So, you know,
by he, you mean Trump? You're saying the polls are showing that Trump is tied with Clinton or
yeah,
a little
Hillary.
Bit ahead?
In those states, yes, the latest one. And so, you know, I think it's she better. And her unfavorability just went up to 66%, which is unbelievable. I mean, his are high, too. However, you know, Tom Kaine, if she's thinking of putting him on the ticket, won't cut it. And I think she should maybe consider Bernie. I don't know if he would go on a ticket with her or somebody like Elizabeth Warren. But, you know, this is kind of frightening at this stage. And what people, I mean, it's like he's got a, you know, like a Teflon candidate. Nothing sticks to him. Almost negative things about him. Thank you, Jane.
Richard, thanks for your call. Appreciate that. Bert Johnson, I haven't seen polls that are showing Clinton and Trump neck and neck, but I have seen, you know, this idea of the question of will young voters who overwhelmingly supported Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primaries be shifting in the same numbers over to Hillary Clinton? Might they just not vote at all? So to Richard's point about, you know, worrying here that Clinton needs to make some moves if she's going to pick up the millennial vote, what do you think?
Well, it's true that young people are some of the worst voters in terms of turnout that we see, and I wouldn't expect that to be much different this year. But in the most recent national poll from Pew, the Pew Research Center, which is quite an extensive, very detailed poll, and it's available on their website, that shows Hillary Clinton about 30 points ahead of Donald Trump among those 18 to 29-year-olds. So it appears as if she's picking up a lot of youth support. Now, again, it may not be that a lot of them will turn out, and that would be consistent with the past, but Trump is not making inroads in that category.
Let's go to Howard calling in from Magog, Canada. Hi, Howard. Go right ahead.
Hi, how are you, Jade?
Well, thanks. What are you thinking?
Good, good. My point I wanted to bring up was I don't understand why Hillary isn't bringing in Bernie as her VP and bring him in on the ticket, because I think anything other than that is she runs the risk of losing the election completely. I don't understand why nobody's brought up the simple fact to make Bernie the VP. Bring all the votes in and work together to win the election.
Yeah, Howard, I take your point and thank you for it. I have been hearing talk about that, although not from Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. Hillary Clinton, once asked about it, was very evasive on that question. Bob Kinzel, is there any chance that Bernie could be VP?
I think it's very, very slight. I think I've seen Hillary Clinton actually say there's no way that it's going to happen. Mm. I don't think Bernie Sanders wants it to happen. If he had a choice going into next year, if the Democrats got control of the Senate, and his choice is vice president or being the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee or perhaps the Health, Education, and Labor Committee, I think he wants to have a position in the Senate and a way to transform the Democratic Party and, as Bert mentioned, to grow this independent movement. And I think he's going to really – there's a very fine line that Bernie needs to walk here. How does he support Hillary Clinton? How does he work to change the Democratic Party? And how does he hold on to this independent movement that he's been able to build? I mean, when you think about, 2 million people sending him donations for this campaign, he's got a lot of people who support this movement, and I think he wants to see it grow.
We're talking today about the endorsement by Bernie Sanders of Hillary Clinton yesterday. We're looking at the politics of that, what that might do in terms of voters. Coming up, we're also going to look at what exactly were the concessions that he got in the Democratic Party platform. Does that platform look like? What difference does it make? Is there any sense that that platform is truly meaningful in terms of where the Democrats go and where policy might go should Hillary Clinton be elected? If you have a question, a thought you'd like to share, a reaction to yesterday's announcement by Bernie Sanders that he is endorsing Hillary Clinton, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're taking a look at what Bernie Sanders supporters are thinking after his strong endorsement of Hillary Clinton yesterday in New Hampshire, and at what Sanders has gained from Democrats in terms of the party's platform. We're talking with Middlebury College professor Bert Johnson and VPR's Bob Kinzel, and hearing from many of you as well. You can share your perspective on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. or by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Mark says, I think the past 5 or 6 weeks of waiting was on Bernie's part, partly to buy him influence in crafting party platform, but also to give Bernie supporters time to mull over the inevitability of the coming Clinton endorsement with the goal of defeating Trump in November. That question of what is going to happen or what was going to happen to the party's platform is somewhat answered. A draft has come out of the platform. This is how Bernie Sanders described it yesterday in Portsmouth.
It is no secret that Hillary Clinton and I disagree on a number of issues. That is what this campaign has been about. That is what democracy is about. But I am happy to tell you that at the Democratic Platform Committee, which ended Sunday night in Orlando, there was a significant coming together between the two campaigns, and we produced by far the most progressive platform in the history of the Democratic Party.
And we're going to get into what some of those platform planks are just a moment here. David is calling in from East Burke. Hi, David. Go right ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. I was wondering, among the negotiations or concessions that were made, allegedly, Bernie Sanders has always taken me to support him because of his views on climate change. Very, very controversial issue. Now, Clinton has always proposed the fact that she wants to continue a lot of what Obama has suggested needs to be done. Obama has always talked about it, but not really kind of come up with a lot of solutions, so to speak. Here and there, yes, but not nearly enough to those of us who really are a bit disturbed by anthropogenic climate change in particular. Now, is there anything maybe with the pipeline? What kind of agreements were made? I guess I should have studied this on my own, but I've been, it's sad to say I'm too busy for politics this week, but what does anybody have as ideas for that?
David, thanks for your call. So, Bob, in terms of what is in the party platform on environmental issues and on climate change, it sounds like Bernie Sanders wasn't able to push through a complete fracking ban in the platform, but what concessions are there?
That's right. I think David would be happy with about 50% of it and not so happy with the other 50%. You know, they're working towards a ban on fracking, and that's sort of a line that you hear a lot in the platform. You know, we're going to be working towards this goal. And it doesn't necessarily say this is going to happen by this date. So the language is a little loose there. There's certainly an acknowledgement in the platform of the serious nature of climate change. But as far as I know, it does not include any kind of carbon tax. There's language about the importance of pricing of carbon products, but not a tax itself. So I think in this particular area, you know, it's sort of half a loaf for people who are very concerned about climate change.
And again, it is a draft. If you actually look at the platform, it draft is written like 60 times across each page. It's a little bit hard to read, but we'll post a link to the platform on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So people like David, if you have the time, you can actually look at what's in it. Also, non-concessions, no Medicare for All plan, although the Democratic platform does say that Democrats believe that health care is a right, not a privilege. No full-throated idea of opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, although Clinton has said she opposes it as well. But Bert Johnson, what did Bernie get in the platform when he says this is the most progressive platform that Democrats have ever had?
Well, there are some things he got in the platform, and there are also some things that he's getting from Hillary Clinton in her rhetoric, as you mentioned, with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think the reason that was not made explicit in the platform is in an effort not to embarrass President Obama, actually. But Hillary Clinton talks about it, and as Bob mentioned earlier, there's a $15 an hour minimum wage in the platform. There's a free public college plank in the platform. There's increased
free
funding
community college, right?
You're right. That's right. Public college. Yeah.
Yeah. But not, but free 2-year college, not free, you know, state
college
for 4 years.
Increased funding for community health centers, as I said, the opposition to spending more money on nuclear weapons modernization. And so all these are planks in the platform that I think going forward, Bernie Sanders and his supporters will want to hold the administration's feet to the fire if there is a Hillary Clinton administration on these kinds of subjects.
Do you think these are all things that would not have been in the platform, Professor Johnson, were it not for Bernie Sanders?
All of them, I'm not sure. I think many of them, however, owe a lot to his efforts and the efforts of his supporters. And to be frank, the willingness of the Clinton campaign and the DNC to be open to changes.
We got a note from Joseph who says, I was a Bernie supporter until his endorsement of Clinton. Now I will either not vote for the first time in almost 50 years or vote third party. And we got a question from Gary who'd like us to explain the importance of the platform if a Democrat is in the White House but Congress is still controlled by the Republicans. Bert Johnson, what do you think?
Well, that's a very good question. And political scientists have thought for decades about whether platforms make any difference at all. And of course, nobody's bound by any specific plank in the platform. Nobody's going to punish Hillary Clinton if she does not abide by the tenets of the platform. But there does seem to be some correspondence between items in the platform and the actions of subsequent administrations. And so there's kind of a chicken and egg problem there as to whether that's just because that's what the administration believes in the first place or whether they're actually paying attention to the platform. I think at the very least, what somebody like Bernie Sanders can do is use the platform as an organizing tool to try to elect candidates that agree with it and try to hold politicians accountable for abiding by it.
Let's go back to our calls. Pete's on the line from Barnett. Hi, Pete. Go right ahead.
Oh, hello. Yeah, I just had a comment. In my view, neither Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump are going to be able to govern the country, you know, come next January, because of the extreme opposition, unlike anything we've ever had before. Neither one of them is going to be able to function as the president. And so as a result of that, I think the traditional political analysis, such as we've been engaging in here for the last several minutes, is simply not going to work. It's just not going to work. This campaign has been unlike anything that's gone before, and this is just the beginning. Everything is going to be different going forward, and I'm not sure that anyone understands that. I don't even think Bernie understands that. It's not going to be like a traditional campaign.
So, Pete, where does that leave you then?
Well, that's a good question. I think where it leaves me is that I need to do what I need to be true to myself, because what else matters? And that means that I am not going to vote for Hillary Clinton. I am not going to vote for Donald Trump. And the chips are just going to have to fall where they may. I don't want to legitimize the upcoming election. I don't want to legitimize either candidate by voting for them. And I think it is entirely appropriate to refrain from voting for either candidate, because it's
Pete,
really
I hear you. Thank you. That's a good point there, and I want to let you know and let others know we just got an announcement from Jill Stein and the Green Party that Jill Stein will be coming to Burlington this Friday. She's going to be speaking at the McClure Multigenerational Center at 7 p.m. on Friday. She is the Green Party presidential candidate, so obviously making a play here for Vermont voters, perhaps Bernie Sanders supporters, to come to her side. Let's go to Bob, who's calling in from Rutland. Hi, Bob. Your thoughts?
Hi. I was just going to say, it'll be interesting to see, like you've noted, if all the media outlets actually allow some of the third-party candidates, like you mentioned, the Green Party and the Libertarian Party, to actually participate, not just think about, but participate in the debates and all the upcoming debates, and they actually acknowledge they exist. So great. Thanks.
Yeah, Bob, thanks for your call. And I haven't heard any announcements yet about debates and televised debates between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. So no word yet on whether Jill Stein or Gary Johnson would be participating in that. Bob, do you think they might be?
Well, I think the trigger there is one of the candidates has to get at least 15% of the polling leading up the several weeks leading up to the first debate. I think it's pretty certain that there will be a series of television debates. And Gary Johnson right now, the Libertarian candidate for president, is polling somewhere 8, 9, 10, 11, 12%. And the question is, can he get up to 15%? Can Jill Stein get up to 15%? Because I think this whole thing changes if all of a sudden these debates feature three or four candidates instead of just two.
Hmm. So in terms of what happens next for Bernie Sanders, I'm curious, Professor Johnson, what you think Bernie does next. Does he, you know, just go back and dive back in at the Senate, where he's been largely absent while he's been running this campaign? Is he going to be out on the stump for Hillary? Is he going to be stumping for candidates who are lower down on the ticket but who support the same things he does? I mean, Bernie has a lot of momentum. Where do you see him going from here in the short term?
Well, in the short term, Bernie's critique of the Democratic Party always had two aspects. One was having to do with substance and policy, and he's dealt with that by altering the platform quite substantially, as we've been talking about. And the other thing he always talks about is process. And so the next step, perhaps, for his supporters would be to get some sort of process reform underway in the Democratic Party. And now we're thinking about the delegate selection process, and we know that he and his supporters favor open primaries, for example, and they might favor an elimination of superdelegates. So that would happen probably as the result of a commission that would be appointed by the Democratic Convention. So what I'll be looking at in the short term is whether that happens, whether a commission gets appointed and whether Sanders can appoint his supporters. to such a commission. But I think after the convention, he will definitely be out on the campaign trail, and it would make sense for him to go to those states where he can do the most good in the fall campaign, both to help the Democratic ticket and to help individual candidates at lower levels, the House, Senate, and even maybe governor and state legislature.
So you do see him maintaining a fairly high profile through the general election campaign season?
I would think so, especially because, as I alluded to earlier, in his email to his supporters, he talked about successor organizations. So this, I would think of something like what was Dean for America and then became Democracy for America, a kind of an organization to rally people around progressive causes, direct money to those causes.
Bob, do you think this changes fundamentally Bernie Sanders' relationship with the Democrats, both the party in general and his colleagues in the Senate, where, of course, he does still work?
Oh, I think it does. He's made it very clear that his future is with the Democratic Party. You know, up until this point, he's caucused with the Democrats, but he hasn't been a Democratic member of the United States Congress. So I think that makes a difference. And I think he's going to give the speech of his life at the Democratic Convention in 2 weeks, where he's going to really bring the House down and really give his praise for a lot of very progressive issues and show how much strength there is within the Democratic Party for those issues.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to that. I'm sure you will hear coverage of that speech on VPR when and however it happens. Bob Kinzel is a VPR reporter and Vermont Edition host based in Montpelier. Thanks for being on the show, Bob.
My pleasure, Jane.
Bert Johnson chairs the political science department at Middlebury College. Thanks to Middlebury College for the use of their studio. And Bert Johnson, thanks to you for being on again.
Always love to be here, Jane.
Coming up, the much-beloved Vermont Mozart Festival folded under significant debt more than 5 years ago, but now it's back, and its leader hopes a different business model will help it survive. We'll find out how next on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. For more than 35 years, a celebrated series of outdoor concerts enthralled Vermont audiences. But the Vermont Mozart Festival folded under significant debt in 2010. A local violinist has decided to bring it back. The newly revamped Vermont Mozart Festival has a different business model, which includes young musicians who are being taught business skills along with the scores. They'll be performing 3 weekends of concerts starting later this month, mostly at the Veterans Memorial Park in South Burlington. Michael Dabrowski, leader of the newly revamped festival, said there was a simple reason he wanted to revive the concert series.
I love the festival. I recognize how important Vermont Mozart Festival was to many families in Vermont, how important it was to businesses in Vermont, how important it was to music. And I loved performing with the group in its last 5 seasons in beautiful places and playing Mozart. And so I thought, why not bring it back? It seems to be a huge loss. And then when I spoke to community members about the possibility of bringing it back, they were all, go for it. Yes, I remember I was proposed to my wife at Shelburne Farms, or my kids grew up going to the festival. So it was that inspiration, and coupled with finding some funding as well.
Where did you find the funding?
MBT Bank immediately stepped up to sponsor the new Vermont Mozart Festival. The whole idea was to try to find a sustainable model, knowing the financial difficulties that the former festival incurred. And immediately, I thought about education. And I thought about the young professionals who are 21 to 29 years old, who leave the leading music conservatories in the country with tremendous debts. And the unemployment rate is so high for classical musicians. And I couldn't find a program in this country that is teaching young professionals business skills. And a part of paying it forward is empowering the artist to also be a community leader, a business leader, to take control of how much you want to play, what you can play, who you want to play with, how much money you possibly can make, the change that you can create in communities. And I think that we have so many wonderful young professional players throughout the country. Why can't they have the opportunity of moving to a community and creating the art there? And they can do both.
So what does that actually look like in practice then for the new Mozart Festival? I mean, what are you actually doing to empower musicians?
Okay. So we, for the first year, we invited, we had 29 openings for musicians, for fellows, and we had a waiting list. We have 33 different colleges represented, from Curtis School, Institute of Music, Yale School of Music, Manhattan School of Music, University of Michigan, Shepherd School in Houston. They provided an application which included their playing and a resume, but they also provided a business idea of what their passion, what would they want to do in the community. And so the way the three-week festival is structured, we rehearse Mozart 9 to 5 through the day and perform Thursday, Friday, Saturday evenings. But simultaneously, the fellows are expected to write career development projects. So they're learning what encompasses a business plan, marketing, the idea, budgeting, reallocation. And so we have 29 new businesses that are going to prosper following our festival. We hope. At least we'll try the idea.
You mentioned that you got funding from NBT Bank, and I should mention that VPR is a media sponsor of the Mozart Festival. Do the musicians involved take some revenue from this as well, then? Is there a sort of a cost-sharing and a revenue-sharing situation set
well,
up?
Well, in part. Again, it's an education program, which is different than, I think, perhaps a performance, professional performance program. These players are incredible. It is an incredible sounding orchestra. We also will have fantastic chamber music. But I remind everyone that it cost us approximately $3,000 to house and feed these musicians. They're staying
per musician?
Per musician. They're staying at Champlain College. We are providing 3 meals a day. We're busing, and we're also teaching business workshops and guest speakers. So that is pretty complicated in terms of cost. So they're not paid a direct artist stipend. We could have done that. We could have said, find your own housing, and we'll pay you $3,000. But I think education is where we want the New Vermont Mozart Festival to thrive.
One of the things the Mozart Festival was known for was its beautiful locations and outdoor settings, and it sounds like you're keeping some of that.
That's right. Well, Vermont is beautiful in the summer. So our rain site, for listeners to know, is going to be the University Mall in South Burlington, which is unusual. My belief is that there's no perfect concert hall. I've played in Carnegie Hall. I've played in major concert halls. Everyone has a flaw. Every concert hall has its disadvantage at a certain point. The advantage of the University Mall is that that's exactly where I'll be rehearsing the orchestra. So the public can actually go to the University Mall in South Burlington between 9 and 5 o'clock. We have a lunch break interval in the middle. And listen to the orchestra at no charge.
Starting when?
Next Tuesday, the 19th. And I think that's, again, it's making it relevant. And, you know, we've growing up, malls had a certain stigma associated with them. And this is a great solution for our needs, whether it's rain or rehearsal, because one, business community wants us to be around. Also, it's air conditioned, it's safe parking, it's accessible. And I think the future of classical music depends on that. And speaking of accessible, our ticket prices for adults are only $15. And children are free to come to our festival.
The original Mozart Festival over the years played hundreds of pieces that were composed by Mozart. And I think he composed, 670 or something?
Yes,
in the
yeah.
600 range, and several mm-hmm. hundred were performed
Correct.
In the Mozart Festival. Are there any particular pieces of work that you are really excited about performing this year?
Well, I love the clarinet concerto. I think that's one of the most special pieces ever written. All the pieces, I think, work for us. We have a few overtures, Marriage of Figaro, that we're doing, the Abduction from Seraglio, which is absolute chaos on stage once we get in the Turkish style going. And then the drama associated with the G minor 25th symphony and the 40th, which is very common. And plus we're doing the Paris symphony, the Linn symphony, the Hofner symphony. The Sinfonia Concertante will be recognized by many. That's for solo viola and violin. I think that for classical music to be interesting, it has to have diversity, basically. So one other example of how it's different this year, in addition to the fellowship, is that we're also going to have a spa outdoors. And the spa is a collaboration with three yoga businesses in the greater Burlington area. And we will feature an area of the property where people can go into downward dog as a group to the first movement of a symphony or second movement while the orchestra is playing. And we also have food trucks. So we have this if people might come for the spa, but they're also going to hear the Mozart. They might hear for the first time.
And people who are there for the Mozart might stay for the downward dog.
They might go for the downward dog as well.
And where will they find it?
At the Veterans Memorial Park in South Burlington.
Well, we will put a link up to all of the events at the new Mozart Festival. It's 3 weeks worth of events.
Yes.
And the latter part of each week. And Michael Dabrowski leads the Vermont Mozart Festival. Thank you so much for talking with us about it.
Thank you very much, Jane.
Michael Dabrowski was highlighting the talents of the college-age classical musicians who will be performing the festival pieces. But before they get to college, younger students are also performing and composing music in Vermont. Anna Scopitone just graduated from Montpelier High School this spring. She'll head to the University of Connecticut Honors College in the fall. And she participated in an online composition mentoring program called Music Comp. She composed a vocal work for the Student Composer Showcase on VPR Classical. Scopitone's composition tells the story of a refugee family from Syria. Here's a performance of her composition and Anna herself explaining the work.
Driving home from Burlington, and it was nighttime. I saw like tire on the side of the road. You know how you sometimes see tire shreds, and I thought, God, how scary it would be to be in a car crash. And then I kind of my mind jumped to fear people must feel when they're on the boat and it's overcrowded. They can't breathe. They have no food or water or very little. It just kind of made me feel super fortunate, and I wanted to do something to bring attention and awareness to this problem. I looked at several different firsthand accounts of crossing and of the experience the refugees have had, and kind of compiled them to create a fictional family of a father, mother, son, and daughter that come to America and receive discrimination here. I wrote it about a family because I really wanted to be four-part tenor, alto, soprano, bass. I thought that it would be really great to have the point of view of each member of a family. One of the lines in the tenor part, which is the first verse, was that my parents are worried and my sister is thin, but at least all the flashes of gunfire are dim. He is seeing how badly this is taking a toll on his parents and his sister, but at least they're safe, or relatively safe, for the time being.
Traveling to places where they think that we are the very same people we're trying to flee.
Over half of Syria's population have left Syria out of fear for their lives, which I think is just unbelievable. And I wanted to write a piece that captures the fear that they feel and the discrimination that they receive when they get to America, if they get to America. I want people listening to this piece to take away the idea that refugees are people just like us who have gone through something really, really hard. They're going through a hard time, and instead of responding at them with hatred and fear, we need to support them with love and acceptance.
Will we ever know? How can we know?
it's okay to be afraid, but I think that bravery is not the absence of fear, but the knowledge that there's something more important than fear.
That was Anna Scopitone describing her composition, Where Do We Go?, which she wrote in collaboration with Music Comp and the Student Composer Showcase. Scopitone just graduated from Montpelier High School, and the performers in her composition were soprano Stephanie Wygand, alto Linda Radke, tenor Eric Nielsen, and bass Eric K. Brooks. Now, Vermont foodies will argue that it's worth it to pay a higher price for premium food products, but how do you know what's promised on the label is what you're actually getting? Scandals like fake Kobe beef and sawdust fillers in Parmesan cheese are far more common than you'd like to think, says tomorrow's guests. We'll be talking with the Vermont author of the new book, Real Food, Fake Food, about false advertising and false labeling in the food market. That's tomorrow on Vermont Edition. Our program is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone, with production assistance from Jake Burstein. Liam Connors directed the show. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.